Chapter 17. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem. When my stay in Jerusalem was nearly over, I rose one morning a great while before day and walked the mile from my hotel to the foot of the Mount of Olives. The sky seemed black at first, but then I saw that it was blue, with a deep, living clarity of color that betrayed the existence somewhere of light. There were many big sharp stars and a silver moon, and toward the east, as I walked down toward the valley, the sky changed to deep red, running to mauve at the horizon. The streets were empty, and I was tempted to tiptoe in order not to disrupt the perfect quiet. Jerusalem at peace. If only there were a way to preserve this, if there were a way to avoid waking the sleeping dogs. Within the mosques and monasteries, others had undoubtedly been awake long before I was and had sent up their prayers for peace and holiness. As I walked along the wall below the Muslim cemetery, four Arabs, their heads tightly wrapped in kefayas, their feet swinging as they rode their donkeys, passed me at a slow clip-clop. And then from St. Stephen's Gate, another robed rider came on horseback and galloped past me up the hill, the hoofs of his horse ringing on the paved road. A cock crowed from inside a little stone house near the gate. There was no sign of life as I passed between the high stone walls of the Russian convent and the Basilica of Agony, winding around and up to the top of the mountain. Arab gardeners were washing the walks of a large modern hotel, but no one paid any attention to me as I wandered over to a stone wall from which I could see the sky over the Judean hills and the desert of Moab. It had turned a deep orange red. The Dead Sea lay, a pale dim strip visible in sections between the bare hills. The tower of the Russian monastery was a thin pointer against the sky. The lights of the village of Bethany below a few tiny perforations in the darkness. The village looked, in fact, very much like the Christmas card pictures of the little town of Bethlehem, and the morning star might have been the wondrous one the Magi had followed. But I had been to Bethany and knew that although it had its square stone houses piled on the hillsides and its quiet gardens of roses, lavender and acacia, it had palatial modern homes as well, belonging to wealthy Arabs. Progress had wrought plenty of changes in old village life. What further and more rapid changes would Israel require? What would they do with those crumbling, cracker-dry hills between me and the Dead Sea? The watchword in a newspaper article that I saw said, "Get every Bedouin out of a tent and into an apartment building." The Arabs had lived without hurry, as it were, letting the land be what it was, letting those who wanted to live in tents live in tents, extracting from their plains and hills and valleys only what seemed to them necessary. The Israelis had dedicated themselves to this land to make it theirs, to demand of it more than it had ever given, and there would be no rest for any within its boundaries until their vision was accomplished. The question rose with monotonous regularity. Can these two cultures live together creatively? Can an Arab become a full-fledged citizen of Israel? Or would the Jewish state, by definition, consign him forever to second class? If all citizens were to be equal, and I heard Israelis say that they sincerely meant them to be, what is the meaning of a Jewish state? No clear formula has yet been found, said the chairman of the East Jerusalem Development Company when he was questioned. Arab students, I learned, were pouring out of the country because they were not permitted to study certain subjects in high school or university. And when they left, they were required to sign a statement declaring that they would never return. Why this requirement? I asked a Jewish friend, for it seemed to give the lie to all protestations of equality. "We are afraid of them," was his simple reply. But Israel pleads for mutual understanding and cooperation. Many Jews are studying Arabic, and special courses are offered in Hebrew to Arabs willing to learn. Joint community projects for the city of Jerusalem have been proposed. A children's band paraded in the streets while I was there, comprising members from both communities. But such efforts give rise to the fear in some Israelis of the demographic threat, meaning that anything that will lead to the opening of a political and social life will place the Jewish state in danger of one day being outvoted or absorbed by an Arab majority. We can cope with this challenge, said an editorial in the Jerusalem Post, by using all our means and energies to bring a great aliyah to Israel, to build a rich, strong Jewish cultural life. The complexities of the problem are enormous. And what of the future of the Arab school child who studies his textbook, I Am an Israeli? How many of the solutions proposed would deserve the same condemnation meted to the false prophets and priests? Quote, they have healed the wound of my people lightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Some dogs began to bark far below in the village. Cocks began to crow and answer each other. A bus ground slowly up the winding road across the ravine, and the sun came suddenly over the Dead Sea. I walked a short distance down the western side of the mountain to another wall where I could sit and see the city. The olive trees on the terraced slopes grew softly green gold. The bells from a dozen churches pealed out the hour of six. A donkey joined the ringing with his mournful, creaking bray, a sound like that of someone dragging heavy furniture across a cement floor. I could see at a single glance the route Jesus must have taken on that last night from the garden where they apprehended him, down across the valley of Kidron and along the hillside to the house of Caiaphas, the high priest, where he was held. There is a church there now, St. Peter in Gallicantu, built to commemorate the imprisonment of Jesus and his forgiveness of Peter, who, at the second crowing of the cock, denied his master for the third time. I had gone there one morning and was glad to find no one else there, only a Dutch priest who answered my knock and took me through the church, courteously and carefully explaining the visible ruins. We descended into the lowest dungeon in which Jesus is believed to have been held, and there knelt together to pray. Afterward, in the sanctuary of the church itself, the priest asked if I had a few moments to sit down. I had, and he began to talk quietly of what it meant to him to know that Jesus, when Peter had three times disavowed any acquaintance with him, had turned and looked upon him. And we are human, as Peter was, said the priest, and apt to make mistakes. But there is that look, that hope. Could you take away with you from Jerusalem any better souvenir than to know that here Jesus had turned and looked upon you? As I looked across the church, now from the Mount of Olives, I wished that I had been able to find words to tell that priest what his simple talk had meant to me. He had no way of knowing that he had spoken directly to my heart. I could see also the outline of the towers where Pilate's court is said to have been, where, though finding nothing criminal about the man, Pilate turned him over to the mob and he was led then along the road to the place of the skull. This road, which runs right through the heart of the old walled city's bazaars, is now the Via Dolorosa, marked with 14 stations where every Friday afternoon, no matter what the weather, Franciscan monks make their pilgrimage to pray and remember what happened at each. I had come to see a new meaning during my Jerusalem visit of the Lord's words in Jeremiah. Ask for the ancient paths where the good way is. Walk in it and find rest for your souls. There is a little chapel called Dominus Flevit on the slope of the Mount of Olives, and its dome was just below where I sat. It commemorates Jesus' lament, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not." To the left of the chapel, I could see the thousands of Jewish graves waiting for the resurrection. For those buried on the mount, it is believed, will be the first to rise. Among the stones were the bunkers and trenches where soldiers had fought for the city they loved so fiercely. We are judged by the phenomenon of Jerusalem. At every point we find ourselves, we meet a mirror at every corner, we sit in judgment on others, and we find ourselves judged. We are all penned together in the prison of disobedience, as the Apostle Paul expressed it, so that if anywhere, for anyone, there is mercy, it is mercy for all. Who can say what transformations will come out of the fire? The prophet Malachi said, "The Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. But who can endure the day of his coming? For he is like a refiner's fire." Down on the Jericho road, Arabs were now on their way to work, some of them on foot, some on donkeys, but most of them packed into swaying buses. A farmer was plowing a very steep bit of hillside just outside St. Stephen's Gate, using a horse and a wooden plow. As the sun climbed high enough to send its rays across the top of the mountain to the city of Jerusalem, I saw first a spot of deep pink in the silver of Al-Aqsa's dome. Then the windows of the Armenian quarter flamed all at once. And after this, all the towers, minarets, domes, and cubes of the city were swept with gold.